Welcome to Wicked, Weird, and Grim. This is your number one podcast for a trip through the history of the odd, haunting, and mystifying. I'm Ara.
And I'm Caroline. Together, we're the Grimm Sisters.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, guys. We have a super interesting topic for you guys today, and we're so excited to start our first episode.
The podcast and just the general theme of it is something I'm so excited for. Nice. Moving forward, I think it's going to be an amazing conglomeration of both of our strengths, which is kind of spooky and mystical and
unsolved mysteries.
And today's story is super interesting. Even if you think that you've heard it before, you should still stick around because we'll kind of be covering 2021 updates to it through scientific studies and theories, and also covering some less known aspects of the tale, which we kind of unearthed. I went a little bit crazy and I read the autopsies and some of the official legal documentation in the Russian because I didn't like the English translations. So
I feel like this is going to be like a theme.
Yeah.
It just keeps reoccurring.
Just like every episode.
All the languages.
Every episode is just going to be like, I didn't like the English translations. So I went in and looked at it myself. But it really did unveil some stuff I hadn't really heard before. So
I guess we'll start off just telling the general story, telling you guys what happened, and then we will transition into theories, pop culture references, and just some crazy offshoot stories. So let's get wicked, weird, and grim and discuss one of the most famous unsolved mysteries to this day, the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Dun dun!
So I imagine a good few of you might have heard of this incident, especially if you're into conspiracy theories, unsolved mysteries, just weird stuff. And so you might be thinking, why are they covering this? It's been covered 1,000 times. But one of the most interesting things about this tale is that every year, new theories, new ideas, new scientific studies come out, and they really demonstrate just how far-reaching and influential this incident was and still is. It happened in 1959, and it's still being covered today. It's still being researched. People are still trying to understand what happened. It's one of those stories that with each year that passes, it just grows more and more in its mystery. So it kind of just had to be done. And that's why we're so excited to cover it for our very first episode.
Kind of starting off, one of the most important things to know is that for the Dyatlov Pass story, the entire trip to the Ural Mountains was because these 9 students who attended Ural State Technical University, they just wanted to earn their grade 3 hiker certification. It was just everyday university students that this story happened to. So that kind of makes it even more terrifying to some extent because it could have been either one of us. Exactly. Yeah. Something that is different is that each group member was already really highly competent in hiking and skiing, and earning a grade 3 essentially meant becoming quote-unquote masters of sport, and it also made them eligible to be instructors, besides the fact that they were earning the highest certification available in the Soviet Union at the time for tourism. The grade 3 required the group to traverse around 300 kilometers, which was 186 miles for our American listeners, and a third of this distance had to be in challenging terrain. It also required them to be on this trek for at least 16 days, I read, with 8 nights spent in an uninhabited region and 6 nights being spent in a tent.
The group's route was approved by their city's route commission, which meant that people would know exactly where the group would be. If there was an emergency, they would be able to follow their plan like to a T and find them. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, they had this plan and were able to utilize it for the rescue and recovery later on.
At the last minute, another member was added to their party, and that was 38-year-old Sasha Zolotaryov, and he was previously certified to go with another expedition of a similar difficulty, and there's not really a lot of information on why he actually was switched over to the Dyatlov group. Maybe it was scheduling, maybe it was they didn't get along with another group, I don't know, but unfortunately, he was put into the group that ended up having this happen to them, and so it's kind of a scary and sad twist of fate. This meant there was now the 38-year-old Sasha Zolotaryov, the group's 23-year-old leader, Igor Dyatlov, who the entire incident was named for, and then 6 other men, Alexander Kolevatov, Rustik Slobodan, Nikolai Tibubrinyo, Yuri Doroshenko, Yuri Krivonishenko, Yuri Yudin, and yes, that is three Yuris, and we'll be using their last names to differentiate between them because it gets really confusing. And then there was also two women, Luda Dubanina and Zina Komogorova.
The group of 10 began their hike on January 27th. Then on January 28th, Yuri Yudin actually had to turn back. He had sciatica and it was really bothering him and he just, you know, couldn't go on anymore. So he turned back. He was actually really heartbroken over this. He said the group was in really good spirits though whenever he left. Of course, little did he know that his sciatica saved his life. And of course, sadly, this was also the last time he would ever see his very, very close friends.
It's insane how this pain was actually what, you know, ended up saving him in the end.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm sure he was so heartbroken that he had to turn around. And then later on, he was like, oh, wait.
Like, was this a sign? Was this something? Like,
maybe we all should have gone back.
Mm-hmm. So this meant that there were now only 9 hikers, which was the 7 men and 2 women. And again, led by Dyatlov, they continued on their trek.
The group stored away surplus food and equipment that would be used for their return trip in the nearby wooded valley. The next day, the group began to move through the pass. And it seems they planned to get over the pass and then make camp on the other side for the next night. But because the snow was really bad, it was really bad weather, they had very little visibility and they lost their direction and they deviated west towards the top of this mountain called Kolat Siakal. When they realized their mistake, the group decided to just go ahead and set up camp there on the slope of the mountain rather than move 0.93 miles downhill to a forested area. This would have offered them some shelter from the weather, but Yuri Yudin actually speculates that Dyatlov probably just didn't want to lose the altitude they already had gained, and he also probably wanted to practice camping on the mountain slope. This was a very bad decision.
Mm-hmm. This ended up being, I guess, the smoking gun, the thing that set everything off. So February 20th, which was roughly 8 days after when the group was supposed to arrive back at the nearby town, the relatives of the group demanded a rescue operation, and the head of the university responded to this by sending the first rescue group, and this consisted of volunteer students and teachers, so people who really closely knew the individuals who were on the hike. And unfortunately, later, the army and the militia forces had to become involved because they needed planes and helicopters to join the operation to really try to find these individuals.
On February 26th, the rescue team did find the group's abandoned tent on Kolat Siakal. The name of this mountain, Kolat Siakal, means dead mountain in the language of the Mansi, who are the indigenous reindeer herders in the local area. The campsite really baffled the search party. Mikhail Sharavin, the student who found the tent, said it was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty, and all of the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind. Investigators said the tent had been cut open from the inside. This is one of the most bizarre parts
confusing,
of the story.
Yeah.
It's really where the mystery kind of begins.
Why would you cut open?
Yeah, like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you
your
just
own
go
tent.
Out? The door, you know. 9 sets of footprints left by people wearing only socks or a single shoe or barefoot could be followed, leading down to the edge of a nearby wood on the opposite side of the pass, almost a mile to the northeast. After 1,600 feet, these tracks were covered with snow. At the forest edge, under a large Siberian cedar or pine, the searchers found visible remains of a small fire.
Between the Siberian tree and the camp, the searchers found 3 more corpses, those of Dyatlov, Komogorova, and Slobodan, who died in poses suggesting that they were attempting to return to the tent. And they were found at distances of around 980, 1570, and 2070 feet, respectively, from that tree. And a medical examination of those first 5 hikers indicated that they died of hypothermia, which, you know,
that's normal.
Exactly. Like, it makes
it's
sense.
Russia.
Exactly.
It's really cold.
It's a blizzard.
Don't go into the Russian winter. Everybody
exactly.
dies when they do that.
And, I mean, the only thing that was kind of weird was Slobodan had a small crack in his skull, but it wasn't thought to have been a fatal injury. And even on the autopsy reports, it said that it wouldn't have been considered a fatal injury. And they think that maybe it would have slowed him down and made it possible for hypothermia to set in more because he was kind of, you know, disoriented. But it definitely wasn't the immediate cause of death.
Right. So at this point, the only like real mystery here is, why did these people leave the tent?
Mm-hmm.
And where are the other four hikers? At this point, everyone's kind of thinking, okay, we're going to find the other four hikers. They're going to have the same kind of injuries and remains. Mm-hmm. They're going to have, you know, just a few scrapes and typical things you'd see on a hiking trip, and they are going to have died of hypothermia.
Mm-hmm.
Finding these other four hikers took more than 2 months, which is a long time. But again, there's a lot of snow to dig through and mm-hmm. stuff, so I guess it's not that weird. They were finally found on May 4th under 13 feet of snow in a ravine 246 feet further into the woods from the Siberian tree. Three of the four were better dressed than the others, and there were signs that some clothing of those who had died first had actually been removed for use by them. Dubonina was wearing Krivonoshenko's burned, torn trousers, and her left foot and shin were wrapped in a torn jacket.
The following medical examination of these four bodies that they found in May completely changed the initial idea of the incident and what they thought had occurred. Three of the hikers had fatal injuries, so it wasn't just hypothermia. Tibu Brignol had major skull damage, and Dubonina and Zoloteryov had major chest fractures as well. According to the forensic expert on the case, the force required to cause the damage to the chest fractures would have been extremely high, like comparable to that of a car crash, he said. And most notably, the bodies had no external wounds associated with the bone fractures. There wasn't contusions or bruising, lacerations, which you would see if they would be subjected to a high level of pressure or like hit by something hard. So that's kind of the, I don't know, the weirdest part of this to me, at least.
All four bodies found at the bottom of the creek in a running stream of water had soft tissue damage to their heads and faces. For example, Dubonina was missing her tongue, eyes, part of her lips, as well as other facial tissue and a fragment of her skull, while Zolotaryov had his eyeballs missing and Kolevatov had his eyebrows gone. The forensic expert who performed the autopsies judged that these injuries happened post-mortem due to the location of the bodies in the stream. Although the temperature was very low, around minus 13 to minus 22 Fahrenheit, with a storm blowing in, the dead were only partially dressed. Some had only one shoe, while others wore only socks. Some were found wrapped in snips of ripped clothes, and it seemed to be they had almost cut off some of the clothes from the people who were already dead.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to survive.
Yeah.
So at the time, the official conclusion was that their group's members had died because of some really big natural force. Avalanches, someone mentioned a hurricane, although I'm not as...
I don't understand how a hurricane would have happened there.
Exactly, me neither.
I don't think that's where hurricanes happen.
Yeah, so the inquest kind of officially stopped on May in 1959 because there really wasn't anyone to point a finger at. There wasn't a guilty party. And all of these files in relation to the incident were sent to a secret archive.
In 1997, it was revealed that the negatives from Krivonoshenko's camera were kept in a private archive of one of the investigators, Lev Ivanov. The film material was donated by Ivanov's daughter to the Dyatlov Foundation, which was founded in 1999 with the help of Earl State Technical University. The diaries of the hiking party fell into Russia's public domain in 2009.
And from there, we kind of covered like most
the
of the
gist of the story.
Yeah, yeah. So now we kind of dive into the weird.
Like,
exactly. So long.
All right. So let's review the facts of the case really fast. Six of the group members died of hypothermia and three had fatal injuries. There were no indications of other people nearby on Kolatsiakul apart from the nine travelers. The tent had been ripped open from within instead of using the actual door to the tent. The victims had died 6 to 8 hours after their last meal. Traces from the camp showed that all of the group members left the campsite of their own accord on foot. Some levels of radiation were found on one victim's clothing.
So to dispel the theory of an attack by the indigenous Mansi people, the forensic expert on the case stated that the fatal injuries of the three bodies that didn't die of hypothermia, they really couldn't have been caused by human beings because, quote, the force of the blows had been too strong and no soft tissue had been damaged, end quote. And so released documents contained no information about the conditions of the skier's internal organs, which was really weird. And just reading back the actual autopsies in the original Russian, there's like little to no mention of the internal organs, like their weight, yeah. if they were containing anything. A couple times when they first opened the bodies, they mentioned, oh, the kidney looks normal, the liver is normal sized, but yeah. there wasn't any in-depth information about them, which you would typically see in a state autopsy. So, and kind of the last thing we need to touch on is that there were no survivors.
Yeah, they all died. All this being said, let's dive into the conspiracy theories, scientific studies, and pop culture references to this infamous unsolved mystery.
So on April 12th of 2018, Zolotaryov's remains were actually exhumed by these journalists of a famous Russian tabloid newspaper, Komsomolskaya Pravda. And contradictory results were obtained. One of the experts said that the character of the injuries resembled someone being knocked down by a car, and the DNA analysis did not reveal any similarity to the DNA of living relatives to Zolotaryov. In addition, it turned out that Zolotaryov's name was not on the list of those buried at the cemetery with the rest of the victims. Nevertheless, the facial reconstruction from Zolotaryov's skull matched the post-war photographs of Zolotaryov, although a lot of journalists expressed suspicions that another person was hiding under Zolotaryov's name after World War II, which I honestly had not heard mentioned before.
Interesting.
It's really, yeah. And something else that I hadn't heard mentioned before, and I actually found in some old Russian letters, was there was actually a child of Zolotaryov who was also named Sasha. And this son was the only living direct descendant of the Dyatlov Nine, because Zolotaryov was 38, yeah. and Sasha was the only one to directly descend from these nine individuals.
That's so sad. The kid lost his dad.
I know. That's not a lot of closure for the family. But I think the family approved to have him exhumed, but there was an interview with one of his stepdaughters, I believe, or a strange something like that. And it seems like there's not a lot of closure around the event, but that they allowed the exhumation because they want that closure.
Right.
And that was supposed to give it to them, but still, it's kind of weird. So,
well, yeah, I mean, this was in the 50s, so these people still have relatives alive today who want to know what happened to their loved ones.
Exactly.
You know, like that little boy Sasha, he probably is alive today wondering what happened to his dad.
Mm-hmm. The thing about Sasha that's also weird is that, so the English was really weird because it was obviously like a transcription of something written in Russian, but I couldn't find the actual Russian documents or the source papers. So it kind of said that the mother of Sasha ended up either giving him away for adoption or something happened where he wasn't living with the family anymore. And essentially she kind of went without knowing him for like the rest of this period. So I don't know if they ever reunited, if he even knows that he's the son of this man. No one really knows, and that's kind of one of the offshoot weird things.
That's wild. In February 2019, Russian authorities reopened the investigation, although only three possible explanations were being considered. An avalanche, a slab avalanche, or a hurricane. The possibility of any kind of crime had been completely discounted, which is probably correct.
I would say so too. Unless it's a supernatural crime. Yes. Paranormal. Extraterrestrial. List all the spooky adjectives.
Yes, all of them. Wicked, weird, and grim.
Exactly.
Now, this isn't the first time that something like this has actually happened, even in just Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Shiveray Pass incident, which occurred in 1973. And it also involved a group of explorers that mysteriously died in the Russian wilderness. Then there was also the Hamar Daban Pass incident, which occurred in 1993, so actually fairly recent, which involved yet another group of explorers mysteriously dying in the Russian wilderness.
To be honest, it's not that surprising people die in the Russian wilderness,
really,
because, like, it's really wilderness.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's in such similar ways
is what is
so weird.
So strange.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start talking about some of the weird stuff.
Weird. Yeah.
Let's start with radiation. So it's so weird that there's like radiation on their clothing.
Yeah.
what's happening? what's going on here?
Any sense? I will say one thing that I heard, and I don't have like a source for this or anything. I just know that I've heard it in other like podcasts I've listened to. Mm-hmm. But I think it was Sasha who worked in maybe like a nuclear plant mm-hmm. or something like that. And so they think that some of the radiation actually might have just been kind of contamination from his work that got okay. onto a lot of his belongings. And then when everybody left the tent, they kind of were just grabbing each other's clothes and, you know, whatever they could find. It's possible that they all got contaminated. But that also doesn't really explain why the scene was handled with the type of care that it was handled with.
For sure.
Because, I mean, these were people taking it seriously. Like, there was a lot of radiation. Like, mm-hmm. if you were just in the area, you could be exposed, that kind of thing.
Exactly. The autopsy notes, they even said that they would bring in, like, a huge barrel of just alcohol.
Yeah.
which is so Russian, to be
very,
honest.
Very
like,
Russian, yeah.
Like, as a Slavic individual. Like, it's very Slavic. But they would bring in this big barrel of alcohol, and it was delivered before, apparently, each of the autopsies. And all of the people who were, like, the technicians, the autopsy head themselves, they would kind of take this alcohol and just clean themselves off with it. All over their bodies, all over instruments, everything like that. And of course, this would help with sanitation, I guess. But, you know, you're dealing with dead bodies. So
it
was very obviously for the radiation. And this was kind of considered to be like an early protection against radiation, which we know today isn't useful at all. But if the military was testing new weapons and there was like a radiation leak, which is one of the major theories.
Yeah.
Why did it only affect those 9 students?
Yeah,
and like, why wasn't the whole area contaminated?
I mean, we know from incidents in Chernobyl and, you know, other serious nuclear accidents mm-hmm. that it kills everything.
Exactly.
It kills everything. And if it doesn't kill it, it usually causes some sort of deformity or something weird. And so it doesn't make sense that they would have radiation on them, but the area, the trees that were nearby, the tree that they tried to climb
exactly.
wouldn't have been affected, but they were.
Kind of near the area near there were a lot of different animals and birds that were found dead, but like it wasn't necessarily confirmed it was radiation. And the local Monsi people, or just local people from the area, they also were told to stop using well water. They had to bring in water from elsewhere. Were they hiding
wrong.
Something? Like,
yeah.
what's going
Suggest
on?
Something was wrong.
Yeah, and the Monsi people were apparently banned from the area for, like, hunting for around 4 years after the incident occurred. So is this just because the area was dangerous, because it was way too popular, because there was radiation? We don't really know, but
fragments of the internal organs of the first 5 bodies were sent in for chemical analysis, and the medical examiner unearthed a signed document stating that the organs had been successfully delivered and were stored in a fridge.
Yeah.
But as soon as the results were known, people came to the laboratory and took the samples away, along with the paperwork.
Dun dun! That's the stuff that conspiracy theories are built on.
It really is. Especially true ones.
Mm-hmm.
Ones that are not silly theories.
Because it's
know?
Like, why take it away if there's nothing to hide?
Yeah.
And that's where all the ideas about, was there an explosion? Was it some type of military rocket or something? You know,
did the Russians cause this to happen? Is the question.
It's always the Russians.
It's always the Russians.
I hate the idea of feeding into stereotypes as a Slavic individual.
Yes. But I mean, for the record, the Soviets were weird.
Mm-hmm.
They did weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The normal people weren't weird, just the government.
I feel that.
Yeah. So Sasha and Luda had really extensive internal injuries. Luda had a massive hemorrhage in the right ventricle, multiple bilateral rib fractures, and internal bleeding into the thoracic cavity with no signs of external bruising or lacerations. Quote, the said damage was probably caused by an impact of great force, causing severe closed lethal trauma to the chest of Dubonina. The trauma was caused during life and is the result of high force impact with a subsequent fall or throw. Luda's stomach also contained about 100 grams of this dark brown mucosal mass. It's often misquoted as being coagulated blood. It's used by some as an indication that her heart was beating and blood was flowing when her tongue was removed from her mouth. That's upsetting.
Exactly. But that also kind of contrasts with the initial idea that it was all scavengers post-mortem. Blood, yeah.
You know, bugs and stuff. I know that it is possible in certain circumstances for people to literally bite through their tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that she did it to herself.
Yeah.
And then the tongue just got lost or rotted away or whatever.
Yeah. Although I typically think that when you bite through your tongue, the stub usually remains because you can't bite that far back.
Yeah.
And to me, it sounded like
the whole
tongue piece, and part of like the mouth floor was actually gone, which is kind of weird, but
yeah,
to me it does sound like eaten by scavengers. But according to one of the military captains that was interviewed in the Russian transcripts, he said, and this is the English translation, quote, "There were no traces. I have not seen dog nor wolf tracks, as some have thought could be the case," end quote. And of course that doesn't account for birds and such, but as it was said, there wasn't a lot of birds in the area.
Yeah. That's something that I always think about too, and that is, what kind of animals live up there that really are going to prey on something? I mean, obviously there has to be some animals up there, but I feel like there would be some, like, few and far between.
Yeah.
You know, it wouldn't be the way it is around where we live, where they're everywhere, you know? And there wouldn't be, I guess, as many flies and maggots and stuff like that.
Yeah. Which is why, I mean, it was good that the snow was there at least, because it slowed decomp. So
it did. Yeah.
That was helpful in the overall autopsy.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I think around here they would have just been finding really, really decomposed bodies.
Yeah.
If that happened, even in our mountains, because our mountains are not cold.
Mm-mm. So internal injuries to Sasha were really surprisingly similar to Luda's. So he also had a massive internal hemorrhage in his lungs instead of thoracic cavity. And he also had those multiple fractures to the ribs, particularly on the right side of his body. And again, there's no signs of external bruising or lacerations. And the autopsy documentation said, quote, "The above-mentioned multiple fractures of Zolotaryov's ribs with hemorrhaging into the pleural cavity were caused, while he was alive, as caused by a high-power impact to the chest of Zolotaryov at the moment of a fall, being squeezed, or thrown." End quote. It's so weird that they would mention being squeezed or thrown. That's kind of... okay.
Yeah.
So again, we just see that it's so weird that both Luda and Sasha had these incredible massive hemorrhages in their bodies and very similar internal injuries, but no external to be found. Of course, you have the normal lividity where the blood settles after death, but nowhere near the chest area, and it didn't show any signs of bruising or laceration. So
yeah, it's all very confusing.
It's
like every time you think you're like, oh, okay, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Then you turn around and read something else and you're like, wait, but then that doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah.
It's just every single time.
I also think as more people cover this, things kind of, you know, it's like a game of telephone.
Oh, yeah,
so, like,
for sure. Things get added to
exactly.
the story that are not really that ordinary.
Mm-hmm. Getting, actually reading the Russian autopsies, I didn't see almost any mention of their skin being darker brown in color or like orange, as like some people have talked about, like radiation has caused like orangeness to their skin. There was a couple where they indicated that the skin was browner, but it just seemed like it was grayish brown due to normal decomposition. So that's kind of another thing that was a little bit different. And again, it was also probably due to most of them weren't entirely closed, so normal exposure to really high altitude sun. So
yeah, the sun, the wind, just
exactly.
the cold in general. I mean, that can like kind of create weird burns and stuff.
Exactly.
Issues on the skin.
Yeah.
You know?
So
I think that's probably one of those things that's actually very normal and not one of the suspicious things.
Yeah.
So another thing that we know is that some of the hikers, once they left the tent, they had gone to this cedar tree where they built a fire, and it's thought that they tried to climb the tree. The military captain that was interviewed in all of the Russian transcripts actually said that at the bottom of the tree, there were branches broken off, and they were pretty much broken off as high as a person could reach. So it's clear that they had broken the branches themselves in order probably to build the fire. What
yeah.
do you think? Another branch was broken at a height of 15 feet. He said that the branches were pretty thick, So it probably was a situation where they were jumping up, hanging on the branches until they broke, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't something where, it wasn't like twigs that they could snap off. These were big.
It's like a big Siberian pines or cedar.
Like a big tree. Yeah. And they were having to work really, really hard. This actually probably accounts for the fact that the people who were found around this tree, they all had sort of scrapes and cuts and stuff on their hands mm-hmm. and arms, which suggests that they were, in fact, breaking these branches, hanging on the tree, doing whatever they could to build this fire. And they just kind of got a little beat up along the way. One thing that I thought about, I know that one of those guys is the one who had the, like, minor cracked skull.
Mm-hmm. I think that was Slobodan.
Yeah, Slobodan. So he has this minor cracked skull. I wonder if that could have happened by him trying to climb up and get branches and falling.
Yeah, I thought about that too. But then I was like, to what extent can you crack your skull if you're falling on snow? Which it also depends off it if it's, like, ice covered or, you know, but...
He could have hit another branch, though.
That's true. You know? Very
like,
true.
He had climbed up.
Especially
something.
If they said the branches were thick.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good connection.
Yeah.
How close was he found to the tree again?
I think he was pretty close, but I could be wrong.
It gets very confusing, like, trying to track them. He was a little bit away from the tree, so he was the second farthest away from the tree. So it looks like he was trying to get back to the tent. I mean, they all were, but...
Yeah.
So, because Doroshenko and Krivonoshenko were right by the tree, and then it was Dyatlov a little bit away, and then Slobodan a little bit farther than that.
Okay. Yeah, because they were all, like, kind of crawling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Which makes it even, like...
The desperation in that.
Exactly.
It's just so sad. It reminds me a lot of, you can literally see pictures of this, and it's heartbreaking, but at Mount Everest, people die up there.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's such a high altitude, and it's so hard just to get up there in the first place, there's no way for them to really retrieve bodies. So there are dead bodies now on the mountain that are landmarks to hikers. You know, there's one that's called, like, Green Boots, and then I think there's a woman, I can't remember what they call her, but there's a couple of them. And you can literally see pictures that people have taken of them, which is really disturbing
mm-hmm.
and sad. But it kind of reminds me of that because I always think, like, the desperation those people felt knowing that there was no way out for them, that they were stuck.
Yeah.
There was nowhere to go.
Also, just being so close yet so far because they were still, I don't know, like, a good 1,000 feet or, like, more from the tree.
Yeah.
So, like, even farther from the actual tent. But
again,
it goes to show, like, it was so cold out there that they died on the way and also not being able to see the tent probably.
It's the middle of the night, so,
It's just, like, really sad just imagining. You know it's there.
But you can't get to it.
Mm-hmm. It's very depressing.
I always think, like, one of the worst ways to die would be a situation like that where you know there's just no chance. You know, like, you have the chance. It's right there.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't get to it.
Yeah.
And so you know that you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing you can do about it. And that's kind of what I feel like at least some of them probably went through. So there was initial speculation that the indigenous people of the area, the Mansi, had attacked and murdered the group for encroaching upon their lands. And several Mansi were actually interrogated, but the investigation indicated that the nature of the deaths just didn't support this hypothesis at all. Only the hikers' footprints were visible, and they, you know, there was no sign of any sort of fight or struggle like that.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the captains actually indicated that the Mansi people were actually really helpful when it came to the actual incident.
They know that area better than
anybody
does, and they were the ones who, you know, could say, hey, you know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely really helpful for the investigation as a whole.
For sure. So now we're actually to the real theories because we've gone through all of the fun, gory stuff. All right. So the main, like, scientific theory that you will hear is that there was an avalanche.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't like this theory.
Mm-mm.
We don't like it at
all.
I think you feel even more strongly than I do about that.
Yeah, I just...
Talk about it.
Even if it was a slab avalanche, which is, like, essentially where enough snow piles up in one area that it kind of creates a little overhang or a hill in itself.
Like an awning.
Exactly. And then that kind of, either through wind or, you know, any type of anything, it breaks off in a slab. And people think that the tent was essentially right under what this slab avalanche would be. And thus, when the slab fell, it would fall on the tent.
Like, right on top of
it. Exactly. It just doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't make sense to me because I guess I could see cutting open the tent to try to get out. But, like, again, you have to go through all of that snow. And then there's also the fact that you're not supposed to, per se, allow more snow into your area when there's an avalanche, which they would know, I would think, being grade 2 hikers. Typically, the best idea to move forward with when you're in an avalanche is to try to have the person on the topmost, who's the closest to the surface, get out themselves first and then try to have everyone else excavated, so to speak. But I don't know, I don't think they would necessarily just immediately start slashing the tent, allowing the snow in there, and then also not put on their gear and stuff. But again, it was in the middle of the night. They could have been disoriented and scared.
They would have been really freaked out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can have all the training in the world, and then when the actual thing happens, you don't do it, you know? I think also the thing with the avalanche is every time I feel like I hear like a really good expert talk about it, I'm like, oh, you know what? That makes perfect sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if the avalanche hit them, it would have been tons of snow that hit them, even if it was a slab avalanche. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, you know, it would have caused like some broken ribs and internal injuries and all that kind of stuff. But even then, I still think it would have led to bruising, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's just no way that you get hit with something that heavy, even if it is something like
literally
snow and ice.
They said the force of like a car being driven into them.
Yeah.
Like, that's also just the weirdest thing to me, because having competed in forensic science, it's very rare that there's not some external sign of injury if you have that severe amount.
Thing.
Exactly.
The strangest thing.
And especially with like internal bleeding, you should see some type of discoloration, which...
Something I was thinking about was, it almost makes me wonder if something had killed them before they got the crushing injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that were the case, then they wouldn't have
exactly
had losing, you know, because
that was post-mortem.
The blood would not have done that.
Yeah.
But
the thing is, like,
it's like, well, how did they die? So,
yeah. There also wouldn't have been, like, internal bleeding if it was postmortem.
Yeah,
maybe
true,
if it was perimortem, like, around the time of death when the blood is still...
Yeah, we just didn't have time.
It's
still...
It's kind of weird, especially because for, I think, was it Luda where it filled her thoracic cavity?
Yeah,
like, if it
hers
filled her thoracic
intense.
Cavity, then that, like, it wouldn't have been, like, after death. And then for Sasha, I think it filled his lungs. I can't see that happening.
Right. I mean, that's probably what killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So probably couldn't breathe. It's just weird, guys.
It's so weird.
It's so strange.
And just, I don't know, like, we can rule out the hurricane. That's
oh,
not
yeah.
even.
That is so weird. Like, I just don't, I know we've mentioned this now, like, multiple times, but.
We just really hate this theory.
It just doesn't make sense, okay? It just does not make sense. And I had never heard that theory until you actually, like, mentioned it. And I was just like, what?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a reason I've never heard it before. And I think that reason is that nobody thinks
exactly,
it's a good theory.
Exactly. In relation to, like, the actual slab avalanche, they think there's a chance that katabatic winds, which are basically these super strong, very
crazy
forceful winds, would have kind of caused this. And there's also the idea that the katabatic winds created what's called infrasound.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about that?
Yeah,
I don't know
so
it as well.
So infrasound is, most of us have probably had an experience with infrasound at some point, because it can actually be caused by, like, a lot of really common things. Like, if you've ever been around fans that are in, like, industrial buildings and you've been really close to it, it can create infrasound, which is like this noise that is just below the frequency that we can hear, but it still affects the body and it causes a lot of really, like, intense physical reactions. It can make people
go crazy.
Sick. It can make people really kind of lose their minds a little bit, because it's like a horrible noise.
Mm-hmm.
It causes people really intense feeling of, like, fear and dread.
Paranoia.
You know, like, something horrible is about to happen, or, like, they've just got to get out of this area. It can keep people from sleeping if it's something going on in their house or their other, whatever their sleeping environment is. It causes people shortness of breath. It can just cause a lot of problems. And so one theory is that there's this phenomenon called the Karman Vortex Street. And I am by no means, like, a meteorologist or a scientist or anybody who understands, like, weather phenomena. So I'm going to probably make some mistakes in explaining this. But basically, Karman Vortex Street, I think it kind of is just this really intense wind phenomenon. And it probably would have, or could have at least, caused small tornadoes in the area that the Dyatlov group was hanging out. And obviously, tornadoes are really loud.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that the tornadoes, they wouldn't have been like huge tornadoes, but they would have been big enough to take like a roof off of a barn or, you know, something like that. So there's this crazy noise all around them.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Carmen Vortex streets have been known to cause infrasound. So it's possible that the group is literally hearing this horrifying noise, and then at the same time, infrasound is causing them to experience this really intense feeling of like fear and dread and anxiety, and they're just sitting there going, oh my gosh, we have to get out of here. 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 And so they just, in desperation, cut their way out of the tent.
Mm-hmm.
And
which makes more sense to me, because to me, cutting through the tent means it's like they didn't have the idea to go through the actual front.
There's just some sort of like crazy desperation.
Exactly. Because why would they risk one of their only structures that was keeping them from the outside forces?
Yeah, like it explains that a lot. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that it really doesn't explain is how they died, why they had these injuries, why they were never able to get back to the tent, why they couldn't get their clothes back on, why they all got separated. Those same questions that just keep coming up.
So I feel like if that had been the case and there were that extreme amount of wind, wouldn't there be like
trees down.
Debris, trees
everywhere. And I mean, I know a lot of debris could have been covered up by snow, because I know it snowed like at some point between the time that they died and they were found.
Mm-hmm.
But they obviously dug through all of that snow to find the bodies, to find the tent, to find their camp. So you'd think that they would have been finding, you know, limbs and pine needles.
Exactly.
And, you know, who knows what else all over the place.
Yeah.
Like I said, that Carmen Vortex Street thing, it literally causes these weird, like, tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, trees would be down everywhere.
Exactly. And also, maybe the tent was still there and still pitched perfectly fine.
Exactly.
There was only a small amount of snow on it.
Which is why, to me, the avalanche doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
It's because it wasn't buried.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just weird. But I definitely do wonder if maybe there wasn't weather causing the infrasound, but I really think that something caused that. And I sent at least some of them into a panic. And I wonder maybe if it wasn't a situation where they were all in a panic, but some of them were, and the others were kind of like, you know, running after them to calm them down.
Yeah.
And then something else happened.
Exactly.
Maybe something related to the infrasound. Maybe some sort of military accident or something like that that caused the infrasound, then came into their territory and caused these horrific injuries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just so weird.
So weird.
And it's so hard to understand, too, because there's so many components to this tale.
It is.
New things are added, like I said, every year, every time there's...
Yeah.
And something that's really interesting that is kind of just a reference to pop culture is scientists used animation techniques from the movie Frozen to remodel the Dyatlov incident and use it in a scientific study that looked at the slab avalanche as well as katabatic winds and this infrasound idea, kind of molded that all together. So that was really cool for me. I was like, Frozen kind of helps with that.
That's so cool. Neat. And I mean, it's really true, because if you've watched Frozen, which I assume most people have, the snow looks very real.
It really does.
It looks exactly like snow,
mm-hmm.
like exactly like it's supposed to, which is so cool. It's the reason the movie won a lot of awards.
I think so, yeah.
And you can actually see the video where the scientists are showing like some of the animations they created for this project. And it's just really cool because it looks so real.
And they weren't even like aiming for it to... I mean, they were aiming for it to look real, but, like, to the fact that scientists would come up to them and be like, can we use this programming?
Teach us your skills.
Exactly.
How did you do this? We need your help. I also think it's a cool thing, too, because I feel like in the future, that technology could, you know, help solve other similar mysteries.
Exactly. Like, as technology improves,
problems, you know?
So many crimes and, you know, incidents are, like, solved or better understood, but...
In the weirdest ways.
Again, I don't think that necessarily explains this one. So.
I don't either.
And then, like, something else that was kind of mentioned in a lot of the different transcripts of people talking, just different, not, like, physical eyewitness accounts, but just after the event, people mentioned, quote-unquote, balls of fire in the area that had been seen the weeks leading up to and after the student's death. So some said maybe they were missile tests. Others said maybe they were just some type of aurora borealis type thing. Other people were like,
aliens.
Exactly. Like UFOs. the roll of film that they had on their cameras, it actually showed some kind of light like that in one of the photos. But
you know, it was the 50s, so all the photos are like black and white. Mm-hmm. So it is even more difficult to tell like what the photos really are.
Exactly.
I also think it's really cool that the film survived all the like exposure to the elements.
Exactly. Like, I think it's like a testament to how amazingly made these Russian cameras were that they survived the Russian wilderness. Like, please, can we please make our phones like that nowadays?
I know, right?
Drops it once and it shatters.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So
like traumatizing.
Exactly. Let's move on to one of my favorite theories. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily believe it, but I find it more convincing than some of the other ones. So let's talk about this Russian Yeti. Oh, like, no. What is this?
I don't think I'm as impressed by it as you are.
It's just my love of cryptids.
Yeah, I like cryptids too. I think the only issue that I have with it is, again, like, it just doesn't explain like how they wouldn't have like bruises and
that's
stuff
true
like that,
it
just really doesn't make sense. But I know that people have said before, like, oh, you know, the Yeti attacked them and the Yeti is so strong, like, that's how they got these like car crash injuries.
Mm-hmm.
The Yeti is really strong. And then also some people said they thought maybe the couple of guys who were, like, you know, building a fire with the tree branches, that maybe they had actually tried to climb the tree to get away from the Yeti.
Yeah.
I've heard that before. But otherwise, I don't like it.
Yeah. I like it. The major thing for me, mm-hmm, is that when you look at some of the camera roll that was found at the site, there is a picture taken by one of the students of what appears to be a supernaturally tall figure behind a tree. And it could be someone in just their gear peeking out from behind a tree playing a joke. But I don't know. I'm more inclined to
think it's the Yeti.
Exactly. Yeah. Although I'm getting kind of Goatman vibes from it. Oh, this is Goatman's tree. He moved to the Russian wilderness.
do you remember a few years ago there was this, like, I guess a mockumentary on maybe Animal Planet or National Geographic, and it was the one about mermaids.
Yes, I literally watched that just the other night.
People got really duped by it.
Yeah,
that it was real, and it was just this big thing. And you know, they made another one about this.
About the Dyatlov Pat. Oh my gosh!
And the whole thing is, of course, like, oh, the Yeti did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so after, I feel like after watching that, I can't take the Yeti seriously, like, because I'm like, oh no, they like ruined.
That's what they want you to think, Caroline. It's a conspiracy. National Geographic is actually the KGB.
But
I mean, yeah, it could totally be just one of them, like, peeking out from behind a tree. Honestly, it's one of the blurrier photos, so of course it is. But
I mean, are there any pictures of the Yeti that are not blurry? No.
My dad. One time I was on a Zoom call with my friends, and like, he walked in shirtless, and I was like, a wild Yeti spotting. And he's like, oh, did I scar your friends? I don't know if I can keep this part on the podcast, because I don't know how I'll feel about it. But yeah, the Yeti is definitely one of my more favorite theories, but I don't necessarily think it's the most believable.
Yeah.
It's one of the fun ones,
fun,
you know?
Yeah.
It's fun to...
It's fun. It would make a good movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like you said, like, the tree thing is kind of more convincing, because,
right,
like, although for the one that's, like, 15 feet tall, I was like, I wonder if that's him.
Yeah.
But, and then again, the Monsi people of the area actually have a Yeti figure and their folklore.
Right.
So it's the Menk, and it's part of Siberian oral tradition, and it's a forest spirit. It doesn't necessarily say what it's supposed to look like, but it just says that it can have supernatural powers, and it's considered to be like a human, but a spirit of the parallel forest world. And in the popular culture section, and I am on Wikipedia, because despite what people think, it's more of a reliable source than many say.
I mean, it's literally cited.
Yeah, it has such thorough reviews too.
It does, yeah.
Because if you try to post something, people will literally like clamp down on you in 3 seconds. So in the popular culture section, it says, according to a skeptical investigator, Benjamin Radford, a 2014 Discovery Channel program that suggested a Menk was responsible for deaths in the Dyatlov Pass incident is, quote, a textbook example of modern cable TV mystery mongering, end quote. So, there's the Discovery Channel there's thing you were talking about. Although I said National Geographic, but sorry, Nat Geo.
In the future, whenever we do like a real Bigfoot episode, I have a video for you.
Oh. Subscribe to our OnlyFans. Okay, I'm intrigued now.
Oh my gosh. It is this
like a good video or like this is hoaxy?
Oh boy. So, long ago, when I was like 13, there was this TV show on National Geographic called Is It Real?
Okay, I used to watch that.
It's one of my fave.
It's your origin story.
Kind of shows, right? It's like it's very good, very good documentaries. And they have this one episode about Bigfoot, and there's this interesting lady on there that they interview who claims that a family of Bigfoots lived behind her house.
Why am I already laughing?
She's friends with them. And that they're like neighbors, you know what I mean? Like, the Bigfoots will bring her, like, I don't know, berries or whatever, and then she'll give them, like, butter. Or, like, whatever they need.
So they started a trade relationship.
Yeah.
Capitalism is not in the books for them.
No, she knows the Bigfoot leader's name, she says.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
What does that sound like?
And she talks about, like,
making, like, Chewbacca noises.
Yeah, I just remember watching it because I had never seen the whole series. And then for a little while when I was in college, it was on Netflix. And so I would just sit there and, like, binge it. And when this episode came on, I think I just stopped what I was doing. And I was just like, excuse me? What is happening here?
Why do I feel like this is in Appalachia?
I'm sure it is. She's making everyone look bad in her whole community.
Exactly.
I'm just gonna say, I wonder, let me see if I can find her. Oh my goodness.
I always wonder if people who have tales like that, that kind of make other tales look more fictional, I would say. What if they're actually real? And everyone's giving this woman a bad rep, but she's actually best friends with her neighbors, the Yetis, and they regularly bring her amazing honey, so... The cottagecore lifestyle that we need.
Apparently there are multiple people who have these claims, but...
I'm not surprised by that at all. Have you heard of the woman who insists that she got impregnated by a ghost? And no, it's not the Virgin Mary.
I think I've heard that. We can't put this that I'm about to read in the podcast. Definitely do not put it in there.
Rated E for explicit?
Woman says she was seduced by Bigfoot's huge erection.
Oh my god, you heard it here first. The internal injuries were caused by Yeti's incorrigible erection.
Oh my gosh. Nancy Hoggart was tending to her crops in Belfair, Washington, when she discovered that Bigfoot was snacking on her precious buds. Since the Sasquatch was nibbling away at her livelihood, Hoggart decided to dispense a little backwoods justice. Armed with a shotgun, she confronted Bigfoot about his decision to turn her pricey pot plants into an afternoon meal. That's when things got a little hairy. Nancy Hoggart allegedly told the website Bigfoot Tracker News, "I pointed my shotgun at him and he put up his hands, scared." That's when I looked down and noticed he had a huge erection between his legs. I hadn't gotten any in a while, and well, from there, it somehow turned into an adult movie. I don't know if he started or if I did. He did me from behind, which felt great.
Okay. All right. Okay, but the fact that this woman is a pot farmer kind of
suggests there was...
It's very fitting for what she's telling us. But then again, it's like, if it wasn't a Yeti, what the heck happened that made her think it was a Yeti? Like, who is she sleeping with?
Oh my god.
It's like, just like the town, like, hairy man or something. She was like, it was Yeti! And it's actually just a man who, like, has never shaved in his entire life.
This gets worse. Since Nancy and Bigfoot, whom she lovingly refers to as John, are having a lot of fun together,
Hoggart is thinking about changing her last name to Bigfoot. What's more, she wouldn't be completely opposed to having a child with a legendary monster.
He'd be called Littlefoot.
Aww.
That's cute. Okay, you heard it here first. That's going to be one of our merch items. Littlefoot. Or maybe it'll be Big Feet equals Big. Like, of course it's Big. Big Feet. What did you expect? What was it, Mary?
Yeah, Nancy.
What did you expect, Nancy? Of course she's a Nancy.
Once I'm pregnant, Bigfoot, or John as I call him, and I are going to settle down and live a quiet, domesticated life in my house. He loves living in the forest, but I'm sick of the long-distance relationship. I have to commute for 3 hours to be with my man. It's getting old, and gas is expensive.
Okay, this cannot be real. This has to be a parody.
To be like, I just, what in the world?
Like, who legitimate, oh my gosh. Wow. What a woman, what a man. Sometimes I like to think evolution led us here today to reading that story. Oh, do we deserve it? Do we truly deserve
this? This is a story on multiple sites. So, like, this lady absolutely believes what she's... Or at least she is pretending to believe what she's telling. I don't think she's telling the truth.
I'm never going to forget that article. I'm going to have that read at my funeral. Or maybe my wedding, actually.
To Bigfoot?
Maybe. You need to have, like, a dating app for that. Bigfoot Online.
But yeah, the lady that I was talking about, she, the one that was in the documentary I watched, her That'd name is cool. Janice Carter.
Janice Carter. Mm-hmm. And what was her claim again?
That she is friends with a Bigfoot who lives behind her house and, like, his whole family.
Well, that seems more credible than Nancy's now.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like it's just a sliding scale of
it's still
believability.
Like, to hear her talk about it is just so funny. Okay, so we have not ended our podcast.
No, we have not.
We're just
going on to cryptids. So, in relation to the Dyatlov event, what do you think is the most likely cause?
I don't know. I feel like it's a combination of things. I feel like maybe there was bad weather. Maybe there was some sort of, like, smaller avalanche of some sort. I don't know. I don't think it's what killed them, but it could have been what caused them to leave the tent. I think that maybe there was some sort of Russian military thing that happened, and that maybe it caused, like, infrasound, and that really scared them and is what caused them to run in the first place, but is also maybe what led to, like, the radiation, the weird injuries, etc. What about you?
I think that the infrasound is really interesting, and I think it's one of the more believable things for me, because I definitely think there had to be at least some type of fear or something that made them so desperate that they sliced open their tent and then also,
just
went out into the wilderness, like, not properly dressed or whatever. Yeah. I don't necessarily believe that just an avalanche could have done it.
No.
Because these are individuals who are very highly trained, were used to this. They were skiers, they were hikers, they were used to the Russian wilderness. So I don't think that the snow per se would have caused them to just abandon a lot of their supplies and their gear in the tent itself. Maybe if they couldn't reach it, but some of them were, like, dressed really well and others were barely dressed at all. So it's one of those things where you're like, I don't know.
Well, and, you know, one thing that I know, for a time in my life, I lived in Montana and I worked at a ski resort. And while I was there, something that I learned, having, you know, never been in, you know, the big mountains, you know, where people were skiing all the time, something I learned really quick is that if you're anywhere close to the mountains at, like, 8 a.m., you're going to hear explosions, and it's because they set off dynamite to basically release any loose snow that might cause an avalanche later in the day. They do this so that the slopes are safe. Even after they have done that, there's always still a risk that they miss something, that
exactly,
you know, there's an area that, you know, they just didn't get very well, or, you know, a small one could happen. I mean, I know one day we had there was a really small avalanche just on a road that went up to the restaurant that I worked in. And basically it was very mountainous and curvy and kind of scary, actually. And one day we are coming down the mountain to go home and, you know, we have to sit there and wait to go around this area that had been hit by an avalanche. And it was like, you know, it didn't really cause any damage. It just knocked over some trees and stuff. And it was a small avalanche. But the thing is that even that small avalanche, it knocked over trees.
Mm-hmm.
It could have hurt you if you had been standing there.
Yeah.
And or had, you know, happened to be the unlucky person driving past at that moment. You know, something would have happened. And something that I became aware of very quickly once I lived there was that avalanches are a thing. You know, in the same way that, you know, here we have to think like, okay, you know, there might be a thunderstorm, flash floods,
or hurricanes,
hurricanes. Occasionally we have like tornadoes, small mm-hmm. tornadoes, things like that. They have avalanches, they mm-hmm. have blizzards, they have these things. And when you are in an environment where that kind of thing happens, especially if you are an extremely experienced, like cross-country, backcountry skier,
mm-hmm.
you are absolutely aware of that all the time.
Yeah.
And so I just have trouble believing that they would have handled an avalanche so badly, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I agree.
Just the level of panic, you know?
Exactly.
The only thing I can think is that maybe if there was an avalanche, I just think they would have heard it.
Yeah.
They're loud.
Same. I mean, I guess with the slab avalanche, there's like a greater likelihood that it would have happened more immediately and they wouldn't necessarily have heard it.
Which is true.
But again, I just don't see it happening either.
And just to me, like we said earlier, you know, the fact that the tent wasn't covered up
mm-hmm.
and it still doesn't explain why they wouldn't have like bruises and mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that from these like cracked ribs and stuff.
Exactly. The only thing I can think of is maybe the body temperature that they were at had an impact on how the blood developed. But it said that lividity was pretty much
normal.
Yeah. So, like, if the lividity is normal, then it typically indicates that the blood should be functioning normally when it comes to bruising and stuff. So,
well, and I mean, the actual injuries, you know, would have happened before any of the hypothermia or anything. And I mean, again, these are really experienced people. So, assumingly, like, when they're in the tent, they're very warm. They're mm-hmm. comfortable. They're not freezing.
Yeah.
There's a reason they didn't have all their clothes on.
Yeah.
You know, when they left the tent,
mm-hmm.
or when they were in the tent, I guess. They didn't have all their clothes on. It makes sense. Because they were warm.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. One of those unsolved mysteries that will, in my case, remain unsolved.
Same. I think it's one of those that, obviously, there's lots of, you know, new scientific theories and these experiments that people have done to be like, oh, you know, we know the answer now. We've solved it. But I think that there are just so many factors that go into it, so many different strange details that I don't think we'll ever be able to, like, all agree that it's been solved.
Exactly. You know? There's always going to be people who are like, it was UFOs.
Yeah.
To each their own, because it is one of those things where you don't know.
I don't think we're ever going to find out. I think it's going to be a mystery forever.
Which I feel is sad in terms of, like, closure for the families and
really
stuff.
Sad.
But I also appreciate the mystery of it. It's one of those things that we keep coming back to.
And something else I also kind of wanted to mention was just the fact that this did happen in the Soviet Union in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
They were extremely secretive. They definitely withheld evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that there are files that don't even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. Tampered with evidence.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And so it is possible that there really is an explanation and we just will never know what it is because evidence has been destroyed or evidence is lost or, you know, was just hidden. So
mm-hmm.
that's also a possibility.
Mm-hmm. But that was also why it was so weird to me why they reopened the case in 2019.
Yeah.
I know it was due to pressure from the journalists at the newspaper, from certain family members,
right.
But I can't see why they would reopen it if there was something to hide, unless they were trying to close it once and for all.
Yeah.
But,
and I mean, again, that's why one thing makes me wonder is, like, are records lost?
Mm-hmm.
Are there things just totally gone forever?
That they got rid of.
Yeah, and maybe they knew that going in, or maybe they didn't know it going in, and, you know, or have been kind of faced with the same issues that we and, you know, all the other podcasters and armchair investigators out mm-hmm. there have been faced with. There seems to be these missing pieces.
Yeah. I mean, whatever it is, it's stayed popular in,
yeah,
in modern pop culture and such, because there's so many movies about it. There's video games about it. There's like a Polish video game that's kind of big about it.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that will continue to keep inspiring people and driving them mad as well.
Yeah,
because I feel like we've been a little bit exposed to infrasound because we're like, what happens? Like, we need to know.
Go crazy.
But yeah, so that is the story of Dyatlov Pass. And we hope that you guys enjoyed. We had a really fun time recording this. Thank you for sticking around with us, baby podcasters.
Yes.
But yeah, we're hoping to release another episode next Wednesday. There are Weird Wednesdays with the Grimm Sisters. You can find our Facebook page as well as our Facebook group, which is at Wicked Weird and Grimm. And that should be the same on Instagram. And on Twitter, it's just Wicked Weird Grimm.
Yeah,
you can also... follow us, rate us on iTunes, give us a 5-star. And then we really hope that you enjoyed getting Wicked, Weird, and Grimm with us. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Yeah.
Bye.
I just waved.
Guys. But because of the snork, the snork storm. Snork juice.
Sounds like Dr.
Seuss. It's from Parks and Rec. She's like, here's more of that snark juice. She's drunk. This has to go in the bloopers.
Oh, Putin. You weirdo.
Putin. It's Putin's fault.
It's all Putin. Putin. Putin did it. All Putin.
When
probably like a child.
When was Putin even born? Putin birthday. 1952, so he was 7 years old, and he caused this because, you know,
he's a god
among mortals.
So he may think. Oh my god.
Just him on top of that horse.
I know. Oh dear, okay.
I am handsome Russian man.
Handsome Russian man.
Oh yes, I am virile stud on a virile stud. I don't know if we should keep that in or not. Rated E for explicit, ladies and gentlemen. Into the thick of it. We're just gonna, you know, turn this into our own little theme song.
Yes, for real. Every week we rewrite it.
Into the UFO. Into the Donner Party. We're bastardizing a children's.
We really are. Worse than TikTok ever could.
I looked up Yeti Monsi and it filled in Yeti Mansion Twilight Princesses.
What?